Nourish and Flourish is a proud supporter of Heritage Radio Network.
Nourish and Flourish, handcrafted, ad-free, print and multimedia content from around the world with stunning photography and video. Subscribe at nourishandflourish.site.
This week on Meat and Three, we're diving straight no chaser into the delicious crossover of the food and jazz worlds.
And I think that sense of nostalgia is what makes it hard to do New Orleans food well, because people just have these memories of these dishes. Certainly people from New Orleans, like, you're never going to make, you know, a gumbo as good as their mother or grandmother made, right?
Comfort food, you got to get your hands dirty, and the jazz is musicians. It's like it all goes together very well, you know?
Check out Meatin' 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are so excited that it's the holiday season. It's a great time to eat, drink, relax, and hang out with good friends. One of our favorite people visits the show, Katie Parla, to talk about her new cookbook, Food of the Italian South. It's a fantastic cookbook, a real deep dive into a region of Italy that we didn't know a lot about, that has a lot of great stories, anecdotes, recipes, and some really unique insights into a region of Italy that is absolutely packed with delicious, delicious, delicious dishes. Then we are at Dangerbird Record Studios to hang out with Cones, aka the Brothers Rosen, who talk about their life and their musical journey, playing in different bands for different peoples, and then finally joining forces to create a music sound that is all their own. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the holiday season here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. About music with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes. We'll be right back.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are with Rome-based cookbook author Katie Parla talking about food of the Italian South. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you for having me back.
Of course. Thank you for coming back. And thank you for all of your wonderful tips for our trip to Italy this year.
So happy to help.
You know, I feel that people probably hit you up all the time for your expertise in different regions. What is the one piece of advice you would give people before they reach out to you for your advice?
I would say look at my website, which has the links that I will send you when you ask me for advice. And I always write back to everyone, whether it's a DM or a tweet or an email. I try to provide as much information as possible. And because I get a lot of similar questions, I've condensed all the answers into easy to use lists and articles. So do write to me. And I will micromanage your caloric intake for your entire trip.
Oh, man. I usually average about a pound a day when I'm there for vacation.
That's great. It's like, what, 0.6 kilos?
Yeah. Not bad. No, it's better when you said kilos. You know, when people travel to Italy now, I know that they're drawn to the bigger cities, as most people are when they go to a country for the first time. But this book specifically and sort of your take on it is that there's other regions that can offer you the same, and I don't want to say better, but are maybe more enriching, touching the country, more experience.
Can I say better?
You can say better. You can say better. I can't say better because I haven't been everywhere like you. But what draws you to these smaller cities? What do you get out of it? And what makes you want to write a whole book on a region that is less traveled than, let's say, when Americans go to the north or the middle of the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a lot of things that attract me to South Italy. So I'm talking about the whole Lower Peninsula. I love national parks. They've got those. I love connecting to people. And you can do that in small towns in a way that it's more difficult to do in cities. And that's people on the street, people who run bakeries, people who have, you know, accommodations for rent. You just have a closer personal experience when you're in places that aren't inundated with tourists and sort of churning out experiences for tourists in a way that's kind of either manufactured or at least like in a somewhat of a rut. I live in Rome. I've been there for 16 years. Obviously, I love it, but I don't have the same enthusiasm for trips to Florence or even Venice, which is magical for sure, as I do for Naples, where you can walk the streets and you hear nothing but Neapolitan dialect most of the time. Like, that is Italy for me, being in a place where you're hearing the local language, not Italian necessarily, but the language that people speak amongst themselves. And yeah, I think it's better to go to places that don't have as many tourists, because you can also really impact the local economy by, I mean, spending your funds in small B&Bs, cafes, bakeries, the list goes on.
You know, you talk about this later in the book, and I was going to get to it later, but you bring up a good point about these economies that are being rebuilt after the disappearance of a lot of people going to the larger cities. And you talk about Franco Pepe and his restaurant, Pepe and Grani. And I apologize for my Italian.
You totally nailed it. That pronunciation was flawless.
But here's a restaurant open up in a town that is disappearing, dying, however you want to say it. And he revitalizes not just the town itself because of this restaurant, because people come in and wait for hours and go to the other businesses, but the network of farmers and producers and things like that. So is there a way that, while there may only be one or two restaurants in a city, that you are helping to rebuild maybe a country through tourism and by shining a spotlight on these smaller regions and cities?
I think the example of Franco Pepe in Caiazzo, which is in the province of Caserta, is a great one because, in fact, before he opened his now pilgrimage destination pizzeria, the entire historical center was dead, barely inhabited. There were few businesses. The ones that did exist were on the main road, facing onto the main road. So you had this really characteristic, like medieval, historical area that was vacant. And I think people like Franco, and he's not alone, do need to serve as ambassadors for their regions and get loud and use social media to attract people. And there are, I think, some small places in Campania, and Pepe and Grani's in Campania. I'm thinking of Reggio Trattoria in Irpinia. They've created sort of a network with a winemaker, Cantina Giardino, a pizzeria, Pignata, La Pignata in Ariano Irpino, and Di Pietro in Melito Irpino. Like all these little villages and small businesses that are kind of conducting business in the same spirit, like natural wine, natural food, farming in an organic way. So I think Pepe and Granny is a great example of like a single individual sort of shining a light on a place and driving business. But other times you need a network, like the one I just mentioned. And those are becoming more and more common.
Do you think that there is this hand and glove shifting of what people want out of food and knowledge and travel that this book also taps into? Because it is very specific. You know, it is not just another pasta book. It's not just another even dishes that you've heard a book just through a different lens. Like, it is super specific. Is that what people want now out of cookbooks and travel experiences?
I think people want to go beyond the greatest hits. And that was something that I definitely thought about when I was selecting the 20 features and 85 recipes for Food of the Italian South. You can get an eggplant parm recipe everywhere.
Yeah.
But what you can't usually find is, you know, Mulignano Cioccolata, this eggplant dish from the Amalfi Coast, which is really only consumed by locals, even though the Amalfi Coast has lots and lots of foreign visitors. So I wanted to sort of inspire people to travel, of course, but then also to think about the story behind recipes, because not everyone can hop on a plane and go and eat these things in situ. So provide them with information on why a dish exists, how it evolved, how it reflects the history of a place. And so that when you look at all those recipes together, you get a good impression of the South, which is a huge area, but with individual examples of what people might eat in a remote village in the mountains versus one in the sea.
You know, a lot of these recipes seems like they have a dozen, two dozen different versions of it.
Mm-hmm.
How did you pick the version, or how did you get maybe the amalgamation of the version that made it into the book and the story that goes with it?
So it was the product of 15 years of traveling to the South and thinking about the interesting people that I had met, the wonderful food artisans, and wanting to feature often just a single thing or two things from a village or a trattoria or a bakery. And although you can find lots of versions of Sica da Munezza, which is a spaghetti, almost like a puttanesca, but with pine nuts and raisins and all sorts of things added in addition. I wanted Angela Ceriello's version because that's the one that I'm most familiar with. I wanted to talk about her and her trattoria in the Bay of Naples area. And it was, yeah, just kind of like thinking of all the versions I had had of a dish, maybe narrowing it down to a single one that I was most excited about. And other times it was more like a memory of a dish that I had had on, you know, a holiday on the Ionian Sea in Puglia and wanted to sort of reverse engineer the dish with techniques that people can actually use at home.
Right. Because some of the stuff that you do talk about, ingredient specific, some of the mozzarella and some of the other local-based ingredients, you cannot find. I mean, Italy's very regional, yeah. Which I didn't really realize until I went there. Like, you can't get some stuff from the South just even in the North, let alone for a cook who's in, I don't know, Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So how do you inspire people to recreate these recipes when, you know, it may not be the best version? Or is it, do you go cook it at home and then get on a plane?
I mean, well, shout out to Madison for its cheese culture.
No, I mean, I picked Madison because, yes.
You can't get great mozzarella in America with, there's almost no exception to this statement.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, like, guys.
Sorry. Romini.
Great cheese curds.
Great cheese curds. Romini in Petaluma is doing great buffalo mozzarella, but they don't make that much and it doesn't travel well. You can get mozzarella curds often when we make pizza. We use caputo. Brothers, like around Lancaster, based.
Shout out.
Cheese curd, shout out to Lancaster and Pennsylvania in general.
Amish country people.
Hell yeah. And I like really believe that if you can get really good domestic ingredients, and you certainly can get wonderful like canned tomatoes, without a doubt, use those. But you can't really substitute other things like buffalo mozzarella. So yeah, get on a plane for that. But for the other things, I was really trying to write this book in a way that everyone could have access in this age of, you know, internet delivery to ingredients. And most people don't have to order anchovies and capers and things from the internet in order to have access to pretty decent versions. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to go to an Italian grocery. In fact, sometimes the Italian grocery has the worst available anchovies. But you can go to a place that is focused on North African or Mediterranean or Middle Eastern things and actually find some similar ingredients and use those.
Before we go to break, there was one interesting passage about ingredients and counterfeiting and the mafia's influence on that, which I had heard about but was surprised that you wrote about in the book, given the sensitive nature of... I mean, I'll say it's safety at times for bringing shining light on that. How does that get combated? How do you deal with it? How do you just get around the fact that sometimes these specialty ingredients are one, counterfeit, but two, that this is sort of an integrated part of life with the mafia controlling these distribution chains of certain types of specialty products?
Well, I'm a skeptical consumer, and the phrase made in Italy doesn't mean enough to me anymore, and it shouldn't mean enough to anyone who's familiar with the huge agri-mafia and widespread counterfeiting of Italian things. So the best thing, agri-mafia. So the best thing you can do is find a purveyor that you trust. We have these in our colloquial language in Italy. We have our fruttivendolo di fiducia, our macellaio di fiducia, and that is basically the noun vendor type plus the one in which we trust as sort of a compound word. And you got to find people who you trust to source things from reputable farms that are not just not counterfeiting, but also not engaging in the modern day slavery practices that are really the central part of Italian agriculture.
I mean, we can get into it a little bit, but that is even playing a part in the national politics of what's going on with the recent resignation of the Italian PM.
Yeah, and about Conte.
And about saying there's a boat that is not being allowed into Italy because it's a, you know, they're working hand in hand with human traffickers and things like that. So it seems like there's two sides of that same coin, and people are sometimes using it for their benefits for national politics and sometimes saying like, hey, this is a real issue.
Without a doubt. Salvini does not want to talk about the fact that he has ended the huge number of migrations that are coming to Italy because that would be bad for his brand.
Salvini's not the best backup choice.
But Italy benefits from migration, legal and otherwise. And there's a reason that our oranges cost €2 a kilo. And it's not because of anything more than slave labor is involved in harvesting them.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to ponder that and come back and talk about the migration of other cultures into Italy and their effect on the cuisine. And then also the disappearance and reemergence of other people in Italy. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
took my hand, jumped into the Black Sea. You said hold tight and let go. The moon is shining down on you.
Nourish and Flourish is a handcrafted, ad-free integration of print and multimedia content from around the world with stunning photography and video. Explore emerging trends in nutrition, regenerative agriculture, and travel. Nourish and Flourish. Thought-provoking content and innovative links to videos allow you to view the future of food and healthy living. Join us on a journey of discovery from the soil to the stars. Subscribe today at nourishandflourish.site.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're with Katie Parla, whose new cookbook memoir, not really memoir.
It's like a travel slash cookbook.
Food of the Italian South is one of this year's must reads.
Thank you.
It's absolutely fantastic. And one of the things that I learned from the book was a little bit of the history of the region. I didn't know that. And while it makes sense now that really the south of Italy, and that we're seeing it right now play out in the news, but really was an entry point into Europe from a lot of people who were fleeing different parts of Africa or the world. I know that you talk about the Balkan populations who make up the town Civita.
Yeah. Right? I mean, what's amazing is that the super long coastline of South Italy has absorbed not just refugees,
yeah,
but conquerors, merchants, traders, anyone who wanted to be in the hub of a thriving economic place for many centuries would head to Palermo or Naples or Bari. These were thriving places, but the one that you reference is part of the Albanian refugee settlement that took place in the 15th century. So imagine that in Molise, Puglia, and some parts of Calabria, you have thousands and thousands of people who speak a language and are part of a culture that dates back 500 years. And their Albanian dialect is different than the modern day Albanian dialects because it evolved in Italy rather than in Albania.
And what also evolved was their food practices. Now, it's always interesting to see what sticks, what gets left behind. You know, there's always oh, we like what you're doing a little bit and we're going to fold it in. Or like, no, this is an absolute rejection. But you have these pockets of Italy, especially along the coastline that you talk about, that have these dishes that only exist in this area. And how many of these dishes only stay, you have to go to this one town to get it, and how many of them have gone beyond and gone to the rest of Italy?
Every village has its own unique cuisine, which can be really similar to the neighboring village or sure, drastically different depending. But I would say every place in the South, has especially holiday dishes that are like unique to that one place.
Mm.
Things for the Assumption of the Virgin, super important holiday, things for Easter, Good Friday, all sorts of festive things, or the Epiphany, whatever Catholic, like name your Catholic holiday, basically.
Right.
And meanwhile, you have other things like, let's say, zuppa di pesce, fish soup or stew, that is made all over the coastline. But in a place like Termoli, for example, which is in Molise, they have decided to put bell peppers in it. Right. So it's a unique addition, but it's not a dramatically different version than you'll find down the coast or on the other side of the peninsula.
It's really those dishes where everyone goes back to their home for that holiday and has that one dish once a year that stays very unique, right? It's not the dish that they make every day where if you're traveling through, you might get like, oh, I had this and I'm going to take it with me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Especially because historically and, you know, to this day, it's not history. It's like modern day Italy. Women do all of the cooking or the vast majority of the non-grilling based cooking. And so the huge range of recipes that used to be part of villages' year-long traditions now been narrowed.
Yeah.
So yeah, you'll go back for like a holiday dish that's unique, but a lot of the things that are on the table are now limited to a small list, whereas, you know, back in the day they might have been a really long litany.
You talk a lot about history in this book, and there's, you know, the 1500s type of stuff, but also more modernized stuff, especially with harvesting both of animals and produce and things like that, and how that's actually affected the cuisine. I like the part about the, and I'll say the Italian just so I say it, but La Raccolata.
La Raccolta.
Nah, you say it better. but the grape harvest.
Yeah.
And about how these were very caloric fueled dishes for the workers. But with the modernization of harvesting grapes and the more, you know, corporatization of it as well, that job went out of style, but so did the food.
Yeah.
How do you save dishes? How do you keep dishes going when they're no longer needed to fuel the lifestyle that's disappearing?
I mean, today in 2019, people do not eat the way that they ate in 1919 or 1819. It doesn't usually take a whole century for an entire set of dishes to vanish. But the really like poverty-driven dishes of the harvest time, like people used to trim up vines and then pickle those like really thin little wispy strands that came off of the vines. It's such a tedious job to do that today. Like, we've got grapevines right out here. And like, I thought, oh, I'll just like pickle a few. It takes like, you know, 4 hours to harvest enough for a meal. But in any event, things naturally evolve. So it's, especially in a place like Italy, people think that it's not an industrial agricultural nation, but it really, since the 1960s and 70s, has really been a mechanized agricultural place where fewer and fewer people work in fields. So yeah, those dishes that people used to gather around the table at lunchtime while harvesting grapes used to consume, they don't eat those anymore. And a lot of the people who do harvest during the let's say August to October or even November period in which grapes are being picked, they're not even necessarily from Italy anymore.
Mm.
So the Italian based labor dishes are gone.
But you also lose something with that. You talk about the annual pig slaughtering and about how every piece was used and the first dish was the blood that was drained, and then they would eat the lungs and the intestines as they continued to slaughter it. And there was this, you know, cyclical nature to the work itself and the food they made. Is anyone keeping that alive? Is there even a point? Is it just a novelty now where it's like, hey, if you want to go to the pig slaughter and drink the blood and eat the intestines like they used to, you can go to this one guy, but it's really only for tourism, and he only does it when, you know, enough people sign up for the experience.
The pig slaughter is 1000% not for tourists. It's something, although I like would definitely go and take part, it's something that many families still continue to do at home.
Because it's not
legal anymore.
That's the biggest thing.
It's illegal to slaughter pigs at home. You have to take your pig to the slaughterhouse. It has to be examined by a vet. The slaughter has to take place in a relatively humane way. So that home slaughter and all of the dishes and items that you either consume immediately or cure for later consumption, like, those are not technically supposed to be made at home anymore. And pig's blood for use in food has been banned since, I think, 1992.
Yeah.
So you get if you just ban one ingredient, which might seem like an obscure one, banning pig's blood saw the end of sanguinaccio, like an entire dessert category that was typical around Carnival, which would often coincide with the slaughter time. So, yeah, traditions die, and let's say it's a good thing to have hygienic and relatively humane conditions as far as you can be humane in a slaughter of an animal being imposed by the government, but you also lose the ritual involved in, like, taking the entire animal, using every part, and never wasting a thing.
I have to imagine that there's more waste now.
There definitely is. Right? Without a doubt, yeah.
They're not saving all that blood.
No.
And they're not saving all those bristles.
No.
So, they're not saving the skin.
The skin is, like, becomes cóctiga, right? So, some of it's being used. Trotters are less and less popular.
Really? I feel like they're taking a swing back.
I mean, in some places, but yeah. You can still get them, don't worry.
You can still get them. You also touch on another meat. You don't provide a recipe for it, but you talk about horse.
Yeah.
I've only had it twice in my life at the same restaurant. I was in Montreal. But it's interesting because you talk about it, but you don't provide a recipe.
Yeah.
What was the decision to highlight, which is arguably one of the most controversial, especially in America, edible meats, but not provide something that was just out of historical tradition, which I don't think anyone would have blinked an eye at in the book, not include that recipe.
Although Congress has lifted the ban on horse slaughter, it is impossible or near impossible to obtain horse meat in the United States.
Sure.
So while I was tempted to have, like, some horse skirt steak appear in the recipe, no one could produce it.
Right. So I guess there you
also,
go.
Also, like, I talk about this when I present the book.
And no, yeah,
people
yeah, yeah.
And, like, you've never seen a crowd turn on you faster than when you talk about eating horse meat. People love horses so much.
Well, they're in the news. Especially especially with the Santa Anita, what's going on at the racetrack right now. Especially in California, it's pretty bad.
Oh, yeah.
So there are so many amazing dishes in this book, and I wanted to, just because I loved so many of them, but I wanted you just to wax and about one that just popped out to me, which was the minestrata maritata.
Minestra maritata.
Okay, fine. Yes.
I think you're doing great, and you have a promising future in Italian.
Look, here's the thing. I nailed the first one, and I just feel very confident. But I just want you to just for me,
yeah,
for 30 seconds on that dish, because that was the one that I go, I'll make this at home. Like, I can actually do this one.
Yeah, minestra maritata is awesome. It's basically like a porky broth made with the bits of your choice. You don't even have to stick to what is in the ingredients list. And lots of bitter greens, escarole, chicory, again, your choice. The recipe is something that is consumed all over South Italy in two periods, around Christmas and around Easter. So you can even sort of adapt the vegetal ingredients to the season, right? Because of course you have a huge shift in what's available from one time to the next. And what I love about this dish is that not that long ago, like in the 90s, 30 years ago, you would find a lot of people before Christmas and before Easter going to forage these greens in the volcanic soils around the Bay of Naples. And now you can go to the market and buy these things and people forage less. But I love this sort of like romantic idea, like the 90s, like Roberto Biagio on the pitch playing soccer while people were going to like harvest bitter wild greens on Vesuvius.
I mean, I feel like it can come back. I feel like people now, if they went to, you know, south of Italy, and they're like, okay, you're going to forage and then make these dishes. That's what people really want these days.
Yeah, people do still forage, to be fair. But, you know, more and more people live in the city now than in the country. Italy has been an urban nation since the 1970s. So people who live in the country, for sure, forage. The minestra maritata name means wetted broths. What has changed, and I don't know if this is a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's probably a good thing because it means the dish will persist. Rather than simmering each individual ingredient in its own pot, you kind of like cook everything in one pot, which makes it something people will actually cook rather than something that people will be like, I don't want to spend all that time and all those pots.
I don't have
cooking.
Six copper pots.
I don't have
pots.
Six copper pots anymore. Yeah. And that's the reality. I mean, things adapt or they don't survive.
I mean, survival is such a testament to this book, because this really is the amalgamation of so many different recipes and things like that. Do you think that this is where cookbooks are headed now, where it is finding a region, finding something that's sort of niche and saying, like, this is important, broad strokes, no one cares anymore. You can get that on the internet. This is what it takes to actually make a book.
That's a great question. I don't know. I think I sort of compare Tasting Rome and Food of the Italian South. And Tasting Rome was more like, here are a bunch of recipes that you can actually find on the internet, but this is the version from this specific place. So you should get this book because you want to reproduce Leonardo Vignoli's Cacio e Pepe from Cesare. Meanwhile, Food of the Italian South is more like, here are some recipes that I think when put together form a portrait of a place. And that has resonated with people far more. I think cookbooks have to walk that delicate balance between being innovative and niche and sharing things that you can't get elsewhere and having mass appeal. Italy, South Italy, like, kind of already has a built-in audience because there are, what, 14 million Italian Americans in the U.S. and most of them are from families that fled the South during a huge economic migration at the turn of the 20th century. I often want to write about the Tarsus Mountains in Turkey and the spectacular cuisine of those places. And, like, unfortunately, the Tarsus Mountains in Turkey don't have as great appeal, mass appeal, as the lower boot. And I find this tragic, but that's the biz.
Yeah. Speaking of the biz, you just got off the road.
Yeah.
Nonstop. Highlights, lowlights. What would you recommend to anyone who's about to head out onto the road in promoting a book?
Oof, get a sponsor. Touring is very expensive. So find someone who's like a natural organic partner that supports what you're doing, you support what they're doing. And that's really the only way to do it. I did 60 events in 35 cities.
I mean, that's wild.
Yeah. Make sure that you look after yourself. Maybe book yourself into a hotel that has a gym. I don't know. Like,
that's an older thing. Yeah. As I got older, younger me was past the gym to the bar. Older me goes, right, can I get up half an hour early and hit the bike? Would love to call for just 20 minutes just mentally to feel that I did it.
Yeah. I mean, I think touring, even 3 years ago when I did it for Tasting Rome, was less like chaos on my body. And now I realize, you know, if you're like over 35, maybe consider a massage between events.
The road is tough. You get older, the road gets tougher.
The road's tough, man.
The road's tough. But fun?
Super fun.
One story? Share one story, one event.
Oh my God. I mean, I just think it has been such a blur, but what has stood out the most are like people whose grandparents had recently passed and like also had not been cooking for a long time. And people were like, you know, my grandfather made, you know, would slaughter whatever his pig illegally in Calabria. And like when he came to America, he used to make his own stuff. And like, you know, thank you for reminding me of that. I'm going to start going to his village. Or
anybody who didn't realize or even know the name of a dish, which is something like grandpa oh, yeah, made, and they saw it, they went, oh my God. This is what this is.
Yeah. I mean, so many people were like, you know, we call it this nonsense name, which was like the Italian...
Grandpa's meatballs.
Exactly.
And you're like, okay. Or like grandma's bread, big bread cheese thing.
Totally. Yeah. And like there are, for a lot of the baking chapter has a ton of like rustic torts and all sorts of things and like breads. And people have often just like, you know, country bread or like casareccio bread, whatever their family happened to call it. Totally generic name, but it's a specific, you know, recipe from a remote town that people are like, that's my family's version. That's amazing.
Oh, that must be awesome because they go, I was always missing that one element. I didn't know because it's never written down. And then go, boom, yeah, I can make
it. Totally. It's so cool.
That's so awesome. Well, Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Where can people get the book? Find you online? All that, those nuts and bolts?
Yeah, Food of the Italian South is available wherever books are sold. You can purchase a signed copy on my Shopify, which is accessible through my website, katieparla.com, and I'm at katieparla on all social media.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's a great book, great read.
So good to see you again.
Good to see you. Makes me want to go back, get in that, just dive off the Amalfi Coast, eat some pasta.
You got
to
do it.
I know. You got to do it. You too can do it. You too.
You got this.
You got this. Get on a plane, save a little money, drink a little less coffee in the States. Go to Italy. We have another song from the archives and then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org. Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are at the legendary Danger Bird Records studio in sunny Silver Lake amidst many of fires.
It's all burning all around us.
Yeah.
I just bought a fire extinguisher today.
Did you?
Yeah.
I feel like that's basic. I feel like you need to buy a generator and they might turn your power off.
You gotta start somewhere.
We have the brothers that make up Cones in the studio. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So you guys have a long history of being in bands, playing with other people and things like that. But as brothers, what is that moment like when you turn to each other and you go, let's just do this for ourselves. Let's just do this on our own without anyone who isn't related to us.
It was a liberating moment. We had been flirting with it for a long time.
Yeah. You're going to say we've been flirting for a long time.
Yeah.
This interview is going in completely. So tell me about when you first looked at
it. It's already getting in. Yeah.
But you start thinking, because, you know, it's like you have a couple beers, you have a couple whiskey, and you go like, fuck that guy. We could do this, right? But that takes a couple of conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that we've always, we've always worked together in some capacity creatively, and just the time arrived where it just felt like a natural progression, and it happened a little later. And
yeah, we were actually on tour in Canada, and it was like near the end of this really long tour. We were playing in this singer Eleanor Friedberger's band.
Ooh, I love her.
Yeah, she's great.
She's great.
She's incredible.
Were we in Vancouver?
Yeah, we were in Vancouver, and it was before we had a bunch of hours to kill before the show, and I was just kind of playing some little thing, and he was like, "What's that?" And then we just kind of in that moment decided when we got back to LA we'd sort of try our own thing together, and that was kind of like this nice inciting moment, you know.
And we had just moved to LA too, so there was like a different spirit to what we were working on.
Because you were in New York, right?
We're from San Francisco, but we've got all three of the big cities between us. We had just moved from New York to LA to just be back in California.
You didn't want to go back to San Francisco? We'll save that for off mic for our two San Francisco. We don't want to upset anyone.
I love San Francisco.
Google, Airbnb.
Yeah.
You know, Twitter.
Yeah.
It's a good local scene there.
Super local scene. Really affordable for an artist.
Exactly.
So what is it in working with each other as brothers that you feel that you can create or make together that you couldn't with other people? Because you were in Ice Water, right?
Yeah, we had a band. Yeah, we had a band called Ice Water.
You're in a band, and so it's like you guys have played together, but there was other people there. Mm-hmm. What was getting rid of everyone but you two giving you versus the other projects?
I think it's tough. What's amazing about playing in a band, like we had a band called Ice Water in New York, and that was the band that was Eleanor Friedberger's backing band as well. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing, what I miss about a project, I'd like to start by saying what I love about that,
yeah,
which is like a group, just like a group of people that would do anything for each other, and you're all in it all together. And it's,
I love that.
It's a great feeling. It is nothing like it. And I don't think I'll ever have necessarily that feeling again. And I think we've actually applied a lot of what we learned there to this iteration, and where you're thinking about everyone's role equally. And you're trying to like squeeze out everyone's perspective and
a lot of ideas.
A lot of ideas, and try, you know, it can be really challenging. And that's the thing that's, I think, easiest with us. Like, I think we've taken a lot from that experience, but Jonathan and I both have very different roles in Cones, and that's why it works. I am not interested in writing songs or writing lyrics. Jonathan's really good at like pop melodies and songwriting and writing lyrics. I like to do more production and arranging and sort of weirder stuff like that. And so we sort of, you know, complete one whole person. Mm. We're both half people.
Also, it's just we can be like the absolute worst versions of ourselves around each other, which is as a brother, you know. I'm sure
as a brother, I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, but yes, I understand that sometimes really understanding who your partner is, mm-hmm. and seeing the worst side of them is somewhat freeing.
Yeah,
and knowing that you cannot walk away from each other.
Totally, like, I've tried.
You've tried.
I've stormed off before.
I have to be the bigger person usually.
Who's older?
I'm a little taller.
No, you're not taller. You have bigger hands.
Bigger
That's right,
hands.
I do have bigger hands. He's older.
He's older.
2.5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
How often does he remind you of that?
Very regularly.
Regular. I don't know. I think I'm pretty cool about all of that.
He lets me hang out with his cool older friends. Yeah. You know.
So how do you like being the, I guess, artistic lead for the songwriting, lyric writing, and knowing that you have the full support of your bandmate who's not trying to be like, okay, so like two for you, one for me, like how are we doing this? Which can happen so many times when you're not strangers, but when you're putting a band or a group together, uh-huh. where you got to feel that everything has to be equal when it probably shouldn't be equal.
Totally, yeah.
Well, he has the illusion of a lead in that, you know, he writes the songs, he's singing them, but I handle the business. Nice. Oh, yeah. I'm taking he's, two yeah. and giving him one there.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
He's,
oh,
yeah.
man. They really stiffed us on those drink tickets. but how do you like having that? I mean, does it free you up that you don't totally. Have to like be like, okay, like let's hear your demo now. That's mm-hmm. a cool riff.
Yeah.
Brad, great stuff.
Cool riff, bro.
cool riff.
Yeah, it's absolutely liberating. And I know that. Yeah, and I also know that, like, whatever I write, it's in good hands when I bring it to him. And, and a lot of the time I'll write something and I'll be like, he'll be like, this verse is good, this pre-chorus sucks. Like, you know, I don't know. It's
I help, you know, tighten it up.
Yeah. And I think sometimes I just have, like, a ton of ideas and what's good about working with Michael is, like, I can just get all the ideas out and not have to worry all the time too hard about, like, refining it perfectly, because I know that I can just bring that amorphous blob to him and he can help me shape it.
I mean, that's awesome. Yeah. That's also great to know that as a producer, you're getting really good raw materials that you like working with.
Yeah, it's ideal. I mean, and I my background is more like technical in general. I studied composition in college and mm-hmm. like a lot of orchestral stuff, and my ideal is just working with material and helping it grow. So
I mean, trusting an editor as well, especially someone who's your brother and family and you're looking to put out the best project together instead of some guy who's like, what's your angle, guy? What's your game, bro?
Yeah. What's your riff, bro?
What's your riff, bro? All right, let's hear a song. What's your riff, bro? What you gonna play for us first?
This song is called Eyes of Propane. It's one of the last tracks we wrote for our record that's out.
Sweet. What's the name of the record?
Pictures of Pictures.
Ooh. We're going to talk about that in a bit. Here we go. Cones at Dangerbird Records Studios on heritageradionetwork.org.
Walking in. Got it instead. I'm seeing you soon. There's nothing but room in my head. Taking pictures of pictures. So long, answering calls from the right numbers till they're on. I felt layers and layers. Walking out away from my room, coming back around with eyes of propane. I wish that you would lie to me, claim to be the one who pulverizes all the fear that is in my heart. You through the territory of space left after blown apart. I know what we'll do. You'll say that it's true. I'll say it is too. The both of us lying in our way. It's Canary Road. You sleep in my grass. I don't even know you. Gone with the morning. Every day. Taking pictures of pictures. So long. Answering calls from the right numbers till they're wrong. I felt layers and layers. Always the same.
Sweet.
My voice disappeared there for a second. Sorry about that.
All good.
I made a couple flubs too. It's okay.
Look at you guys.
It's a Sunday after Halloween.
Oh, yeah. Weekend,
you know?
You guys big Halloween fans?
I love excuse me. Yeah.
What's going on with you right now?
Thinking about his favorite spooky moments. How many times have you watched Hocus Pocus this season?
This season? I haven't watched it this season, but I watched it last season.
Apparently they're doing a remake or a sequel or something.
Yeah, I think I think the trend now is picking up the story 30 years later.
Yeah.
So you're in New York, you come back to LA, you have this inkling of starting a project together. How does it get started? I always love to know that moment when it goes from an idea to something real, because it's very easy to be plucking around a guitar in Vancouver and then you come back to LA and you're like, well, I don't know about this.
Yeah.
Like, how did you move it forward and how did you keep the momentum up?
I had a handful of little songs that I had written that were like ready to be experimented with. So Michael had a studio in the Arts District, swelteringly hot room.
It was not a studio. It was like a practice space.
Yeah.
I have a studio now, fortunately.
I think the first song we really started exploring was a song called First Time that we put out with, one of the first tracks we put out with Danger Bird.
Shout out Danger Bird.
What up?
And shout out to Penny, the best mascot.
Yeah. Penny was in my guitar case earlier. It was a real Kodak moment.
Penny's not a human.
Yeah, Penny's a dog. A pocket dog. So you have these ideas, you have these sketches, you have this quote-unquote room and some recording materials. Was it the start of the process where you took some of his ideas and you thought, I think we can do it like this?
Yeah, I mean, the first couple songs we made were flubs, but the spirit was right. And then, there was just like an energy that I think we had always wanted to have, and a freedom to really create like in an uninhibited way, not having to think about other people really. And we weren't sure what it was going to be. We didn't have a name. We were just making songs. And,
And I think for me as a writer, I had felt that like I had to hold back some of my pop tendons, like impulses a little bit.
Because it wasn't like New York cool?
Kind of a little. You know,
I get that.
Yeah, you know. And so I felt like there was a little bit of sincerity in me that had been kind of suppressed a little for whatever reason. And I think that...
And also because you were writing, the band we were in, you were writing to accommodate the style of that.
Yeah,
band.
Exactly. Yeah.
So right.
There was like no style mind. We just were.
That's a bit freeing.
It was cool.
And then you just take the songs out, and then when do you go like, okay, we're a band?
We made 5 songs, and we had them mixed, and at that point, once we had the goods, we were a band.
The goods.
Yeah, and we've also, through that process too, there's a third member, an unsung hero.
Shout him out, or her out.
Her name's Anna, and she's our manager. And she was, you know, she's a booking agent mainly. She's now at Ground Control.
Oh, cool.
she's like, before we even started, she told us to start our own thing, actually. And so she's been a teammate and a confidant through it all.
So you talked a little bit about how you support each other artistically. But beyond that, and like, because being in a band goes beyond that and being brothers, how do you, in the larger picture, support each other or edit each other as you move as cones forward?
I mean, immediately I can think, like, pursuing your passion in a creative endeavor is very vulnerable, mm-hmm. vulnerable experience. And, I think when either of us are feeling down, hopefully they're not aligning at the same time.
Right.
If they're aligning at the same time, there's no hope. But
right.
Usually we can help pick each other up if we're feeling like a lack of confidence or...
Felt good at the same time.
it's important to be able to do that. And yeah, just keep each other moving forward. There's a time, I don't know if you were planning on getting into this, but we just put out our first record, and we actually had made essentially a record before we put that out that we decided to not.
Yeah, I'd heard about this, that yeah. You have a whole
it's like it just scrapped we album. Made it with we didn't make it in my like in our own studio, and we did it with a friend who's a producer. It was great, and the stuff was really good, but it wasn't completely us, and it was a really tough call to move forward. But like that's a moment where we picked each other up, and
yeah, totally.
I started a recording studio in Lincoln Heights in LA with two buddies. One is Dent May, and the other is Pat Jones. Dent's a great musician around here, and Pat's an amazing engineer. And we built out the studio, and luckily at that time I was ready to use. So we went right back in and picked each other up and made Pictures of Pictures.
I mean, that's the debut album. Like That's your first. You only get one.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not like you can find your other brother project, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's another brother out there. Yeah. But
There could be.
But the fact that this is your first project as brothers and making this decision, you're going to want to get it right.
Yeah. You got to set the tone. We're going to make many more recordings, but this we're very excited about the tone we set with Pictures of Pictures.
Where's the lost album right now?
It's in the cloud. The
Library of Congress.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. NPR played it, and they put it right in the...
We put one of those songs out from that. It's called Run the Risk. It's on all streaming services.
Okay, well, let's hear another song right now, then we'll get into a little bit more of the debut album. Cool. What do you have for us next?
This song's called Stray Lines. It's not available anywhere.
It will be when this drops.
True.
So can we say this is a Snacky Tunes exclusive?
This isn't a Snacky. This is officially. I said Snacky Tunes.
Officially Snacky Tunes exclusive.
Snacky Tunes is it's the 10 p.m. show. It's a little blue. All right, here we go. Cones at Dangerbird Record Studios live on Snacky Tunes, heritageradionetwork.org.
Not yet in the mirror. once I get it there. See it clear, running to and from me and everyone. That's my way.
Very nice.
Thank you.
So let's talk about Pictures of Pictures, the debut album. You decided to get in a band. You got a band. You scrapped the album. When you built the studio, when did everything start clicking? And because now you can like put out a single, you put out an EP, you know, albums are, I don't want to say rare.
Yeah.
But
for, it's not relevant.
As like, we're an indie band, we're putting out the album.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's how we started, but we put out, we put out one single.
Sure.
By ourselves with a video, and that got some attention, and we had an opportunity to put out two singles with a label called, like, we had made this, like, five-song EP that we thought, like, oh, this is an EP, but it ended up being deconstructed and released separate, like, put out two songs with this label called Canvasback.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of like the Atlantic distribution, and that did some really nice stuff for getting us out there. And then we talked to Aaron from Danger Bird, and we put two songs out with them.
Shout out
to the goat.
What up, Penny? Yeah, it's a nice way.
I think Penny's the goat. Penny's sorry, the guys. Goat.
Penny's a dog, but a goat.
Yeah,
goat dog. Yeah, I think like doing it that way, we got to maximize the material. You know, like each track had its own sort of life. You know,
its own attention.
Its own attention. Yeah.
Yeah, and then
we made. Now it was time. I think at that point it was time to make an album. And now we've made an album, and I think we'll see what's up next.
Technically, you made two albums.
We made two albums. Yeah. So
it's
maybe
a double
we'll just,
album.
Maybe we'll resubmit the first album and just be like. Done. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we could turn around, what, in like a day? Yeah, we got an album.
Yeah.
I want to talk about a little of your artistic expressions outside of the band, because, Jonathan, I know that you're an animator.
Yep.
How'd you get into animation, and how do you bring that into the Cones project?
Well, I've been drawing my whole life, basically, and then I studied film at Bard College in my last year. One of my professors kind of turned me on to it. And, like, it just was, like, the most natural thing in the world for me. And I just fell in love with it. And then moved to New York right after I graduated to work for an animator named Bill Plimpton, who is, like, one of my heroes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You worked for Bill Plimpton?
I did, yeah, for a bunch of years. Are you a Plimpton fan?
Huge Plimpton fan. Give me one story.
Oh, man. Okay. One time I was... Oh, well. Okay, one time... He was obsessed with country music. He's like the only thing he cares about. And I was, it was like my first day, and I was listening to like really loud punk music. And he was like trying to bond with me. So he's like, hey, what are you listening to? And I was like, I lied and said that I was listening to country music. That's the first story that popped into my head. I just wanted him to like me.
Yeah.
He sold you an amp.
He did sell me an amp. Yeah. A Fender.
Does he shred? I mean,
he's not really a shredder. He's a crazy dude.
Is he a picker? Like a good like country picker?
I've never actually heard him play guitar, but I got to score one of his shorts. That was cool.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And so you animate some of the videos that
yeah,
you
exactly.
guys do for Cones, right?
So I've animated all our videos except for the last one that we
the first one we revealed our faces. for better or worse.
Oh, how was that?
Scary.
Scarring.
I'm sure your parents were proud. I thought they were the faces.
But yeah, so my vision, you know, it's been really fun to like sort of fuse the music and the art into one separate entity. That's kind of my vision.
I'd like to add that I think the two are sort of interchangeable in that we try to make the music sound the way the animations look, if that makes sense, like a little wobbly and like,
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, if the music feels like the animations and vice versa, we know we're doing on the right path.
I mean, that's nice that you can control, really control the visuals to tie with the music and, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Yeah. So what's next? What are you guys going to do?
Well, the next thing that will be revealed in the world of Cones is my extracurricular activity is I'm a programmer,
right?
More like creative stuff. But we made this app together. I developed it. It's called Bob's Room.
Go on.
And Bob is it's actually on the App Store right now, but we haven't our publicist is finding the right outlet for it, but
and it's not Snacky Tunes, even though we're talking about it. Oh, right now.
Could be.
It probably. I'm gonna
exclusive. I don't know when this will.
I'll tell you right now. I don't know when it's air. Probably not the right one.
No, she's looking for like some because it's a tech project. Anyway, it's like a really weird VR and 360 experience of Jonathan's animations and art, every song from the album sort of hidden in this world, and you can
wow.
interact with it in a really crazy way. You can download it.
I will.
Yeah.
I need a VR headset though, right?
Well, yeah, you could Google Cardboard, but there's VR mode or there's normal mode.
Okay.
So you could do either mode.
Do you find that having these different ways to just get your music and your art out there is absolutely awesome?
Yeah, I think what was amazing about developing this, and it's sort of opening possibilities for other projects in the future, but no matter hopefully people see it and interact with it, and it's a nice thing to have done, but like it sort of is an exclamation point, I think, on like how it's a step further towards how we can collaborate together. Like
yeah.
we've collaborated together with music, and Jonathan does the animation, I do a lot of, you know, technical stuff, and this was like bringing that further, like all the music and the art and the interactivity and everything all into one project, and that was really fun to develop.
Awesome.
We're gonna make a dating app next.
Yeah,
a Cones dating app.
Yeah.
What would your dating app be? Several like radius only.
You started this.
I did start this. I finish it.
Land the joke. Okay. come on.
Oh man, it's you see someone. And if you see something, say something, you know?
Okay.
What was that?
That's a good, you know, that's a...
It's a subway thing.
Okay,
yeah.
So that's his... Do you want to edit that a little bit?
Yeah. yeah, I do.
Actually, the best dating app I ever saw, I can't remember the name, but it only worked when you had 3% or less battery
that's
on your
awesome.
Phone.
Oh, that is good. So it's urgency.
Well, but also you have to be the type of person who lets your phone get down to 3%.
Yeah.
And then it was.
I am that type of person.
Well, there you go.
And I have a girlfriend.
That's a good idea.
But if
yeah.
I didn't have a girlfriend, I would download that app.
Are you trying to date someone who lets their phone get down to 3%?
Yeah.
That's wow. my type. Yeah.
That's my type.
I'm more of a 2% kind of guy. But
yeah. All right. So Cones, where can people find the music? Where can people find the album? Singles, everything.
Spotify, ooh. Amazon.
Spotify, great Deezer. Startup band coming
Deezer?
Out of San Fran.
Deezer, I just wanted to say it.
I don't know what Deezer is.
Tidal, iTunes, Pono. Remember Pono?
Yeah. That was Neil Young.
Is anyone else still surprised that Tidal's around?
I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
it's Jay-Z. Whatever.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I mean, I know, but I've never used it.
Spotify, they won.
they did win.
Yeah,
they won.
Record, vinyl,
vinyl, CD,
8-track.
Sweet.
Okay, then that's it.
YouTube.
Not 8-track.
YouTube for the videos.
YouTube, yeah, totally. There you go.
Yeah, but be careful down the rabbit holes you follow on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's bad out there.
Yeah.
I want to thank Danger Bird Records. I want to thank Heritage Radio. And I want to get one more song in. What's the last song you're going to play?
Oh, we want to thank you, too.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you for the two exclusives, both a song and a news drop.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, I know people think that you got to go on like ABC or CNN and it's Cooper. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Come to Snacky Tunes. You drop the big news.
Yeah. That's I'm getting married. I'm having a kid.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
I'm just kidding.
All right. maybe your dating app could be like two truths and a lie.
Yeah.
And if you just like the whole package.
Yeah, the exclusives we gave you were, you don't know if they were lies or truths.
Yeah, yeah.
Or it's an arranged marriage app. There's dark. Something there. Okay, never mind.
Okay. Social media? Where can people find you on
at Cones the Band.
Yeah.
And conestheband.com.
Okay, sweet. Last song, where are you taking us out with?
We're going to play Moonstone. Some high notes here, so we'll see how
our first single from the record.
Yep.
Sweet. Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone. We'll see you next time. Take it away.
Don't. We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.